Genius by Billy Collins. Genius was what they called you in high school if you tripped on a shoelace in the hall and all your books went flying. Or if you walked into an open locker door, you would be known as Einstein, who imagined riding a streetcar into infinity. Later, genius became someone who could take a sliver of chalk and squire pi 100 places out beyond the decimal point. Or a man painting on his back on a scaffold, or drawing a water wheel in a margin, or spinning out a little night music. But earlier this week, on a wooded path, I thought the swans afloat on the reservoir were the true geniuses. The ones who had figured out how to fly, how to be both beautiful and brutal, and how to mate for life. 24 geniuses in all, for I numbered them as Yeats had done, deployed upon the calm, crystalline surface. 48 if we counted their white reflections, or an even 50 if you want to throw in me and the dog running up ahead, who were at least smart enough to be out that day. She sniffing the ground, me with my head up in the bright morning air. Good morning, and welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan, Kansas. Whatever your faith, whatever your walk in life, you are welcome here. And in that spirit of welcome, please take a moment to greet the people on either side of you. And we encourage you to stay after today's service and continue those conversations. We will now have the lighting of the chalice. Iris Kingery will light the chalice for us this morning. In lighting this chalice, we call into our presence the fire that unites us all. From the molten core at the center of the earth to the fusion of hydrogen in stars that throw off heat and light, to the fire in the nucleus in every cell of every plant and every animal, we all live by burning bright, by shedding our collective light for all to see. Thank you, Iris. And now, as you are able, please stand. We will sing hymn 346, Come Sing a Song with Me.
Thank you.
announcements. I call your attention to the announcements in your bulletin. Please read them to find out what's happening at the fellowship. And now for joys and concerns. Because we are a caring community, we take this moment to acknowledge the joys and concerns of our fellowship. If you would like to briefly share a joy or sorrow from your life, please raise your hand so someone can bring the microphone to you. Doug?
Thank you, Doug. I don't normally do this, so I've got a lot saved up. These are joys and concerns in other events in my life. One is my dad just turned 91 last Thursday. He is in a memory care facility in Los Angeles. He's advanced stages of dementia. Unfortunately, Sybil was able to be there with him, as was my sister who lives in Santa Monica and her husband and their dog. Sybil arranged to have a barbershop quartet come and serenade, which reached him, which reached through the cobwebs of his mind, and he really enjoyed that. This is a joy. Tyler, after 3 years at Boston University, has graduated with his MFA and is jumping on a plane on Tuesday and flying to the West Coast, where he starts working with the CEO of a lighting company based in San Diego, but their first job is in San Francisco, setting up lights for some event in Moscone Center next weekend. So he's on his way. Two other things, I guess. One, I was looking through the UU World the other day, and there's a page in there on In Memoriam, and there's a name there that kind of struck a bell, a Reverend Arthur Wilmot. I don't know how many of you get UU World, but the name is very familiar. I Googled him, and yes, it was indeed the UU minister of our fellowship in Corvallis, Oregon, where Sybil and I started attending UUs about 35 years ago. So Art unfortunately passed away last year. Very, very sad. I wanted to say that as a concern and a memento to him. And then, even though we do have all these events going on, yesterday I went for a bike ride to the east of Tuttle Creek, Tuttle Reservoir, and I was just suffused with joy at how beautiful the surroundings were, how beautiful the morning was, riding along the road. And just like the fellowship, it definitely helped that there's a slight downhill, and I had a tailwind. So through it all, there's still room for joy.
I actually have an announcement to make rather than a joy or concern. I just wanted to announce for anyone who might be interested, there's kind of an informal theology on tap or beer and theology group, grassroots kind of coming together for the first time. And that will be the evening of September 5th at Auntie May's. There's live music from the Tom Page Trio. Some of you might remember Tom Page, my brother, who came and spoke to us here at one point. So that's September 5th at Auntie May's.
I have a piano now, and now I'm going to try piano lessons.
Whoa! Fabulous. Fabulous.
I don't know how many of you have heard, but Melise made it to Oregon. I think there went some emails out, but I don't know whether everybody knows. So she's almost at her destination.
Anyone else? Okay, thank you for sharing your joys and concerns. And we all know that there are many thoughts and feelings that were unspoken, and we honor all of those as well. So now it's time for the story for all ages. So will the kids please come down front, and Marcy will share a story with you.
Good morning. This story is one of my favorites. It's called Where the Wild Things Are. Do you know that story?
Yeah.
I like it. The night that Max wore his wolf suit and made mischief of one kind and another. Look at him. His mother called him Wild Thing, and Max said, I'll eat you up. So he was sent to bed without eating anything. And that night, in Max's room, a forest grew. And grew. And grew until his ceiling hung with vines, and the walls became the world all around. And an ocean tumbled by with a private boat for Max, and he sailed off. Yeah, through night and day. And in and out of weeks and almost over a year to where the wild things are. And when he came to the place where the wild things are, oh, they roared their terrible roars and gnashed their terrible teeth and they rolled their terrible eyes and they showed their terrible claws. Till Max said, be still, and tamed them with the magic trick of staring into all of their yellow eyes without blinking once. And they were frightened and called him the most wild thing of all and made him king of all the wild things. And now, cried Max, let the wild rumpus start. Oh, look at them. They're just rumpusing and rumpusing. More rumpusing. Now stop, Max said, and sent the wild things off to bed without their supper. And Max, the king of all wild things, was lonely and wanted to be where somebody loved him best of all. Then all around, from far away across the world, he smelled good things to eat. So he gave up being king of where the wild things are. But the wild things cried, oh no, please don't go. We'll eat you up. We love you so. But Max said no. The wild things roared their terrible roars and gnashed their terrible teeth and rolled their terrible eyes and showed their terrible claws. But Max stepped into his private boat and waved goodbye and sailed back over a year and in and out of weeks and through a day and into the night of his very own room, where he found his supper waiting for him. And it was still hot.
Why did he not see the supper?
I don't know. We should see the supper, shouldn't we? Well, thank you for letting me share that with you.
Shine your light in all you do.
And now we will have the offertory. It's a great pleasure to be able to introduce our speaker today, Dr. Marcy Lechtenberg. She has been working as a licensed marriage and family therapist and has a strong interest in mindfulness-based therapy. She has over 20 years' experience working with families in school, medical, and clinical settings. She currently teaches and supervises therapists at K-State and, on a personal note, is looking forward to becoming a grandmother for the first time in December. She also has three daughters, she and her husband Kelly, three daughters, three son-in-laws, and four granddogs. So please join me in welcoming Marcy.
Thank you, Diane. Thank you so much for inviting me to speak today. I appreciate any opportunity to talk about mindfulness. And I really appreciate any opportunity to read Where the Wild Things Are. So I think all of us have a little wolf suit that we pull out from time to time and make some mischief of one kind or another. And I know I could always use a little more rumpusing in my life. So for the next few minutes, I would like to share how mindfulness can help us focus on what's important, can help us be more creative, and can also help us find what beauty is for us in our lives. I'm trained as a school counselor and now as a marriage and family therapist, but I first came to mindfulness in kind of a unique way. I taught ninth grade English. And now those of you familiar with English education in the early 80s can kind of remember that the Romeo and Juliet and the O. Henry stories and the Lord of the Flies were kind of few and far between. The main focus was grammar and spelling and diagramming sentences. So how many of you in here have ever actually diagrammed a sentence? I don't know that we do that to kids anymore, and there's probably some good reason for that. But one of the things that I realized is that if it was a diagramming day, there were going to be lots of Maxes with wolf suits on, and there was going to be a lot of rumpusing because there wasn't going to be a whole lot of maybe interest in exactly what we were doing. Now, on the days that we discussed whether Romeo and Juliet were truly in love or whether they were just being overly dramatic teenagers, or if we discussed would you actually sell your most prized possession to buy a gift for a loved one, we didn't have the rumpusing. They were focused. They paid attention. And we really had some good things that happened in our classroom. And I didn't know what to call that, but I tried to figure out, how do I channel that energy? How do I bring that to what we're going to do when things aren't quite the way that we want them? And we now know that focused energy, that paying attention on purpose, is a skill, and it can be taught. And I'm sure, and often that practice of that is what we call mindfulness. And I'm sure that many of you have heard that term mindfulness. It's a really hot topic right now. You hear about it in education. You hear about it in medical settings. I even saw a flyer for a business retreat, and there was a well-known mindfulness speaker who was going to be at the retreat for this business, so it's part of the business community as well. And so it's kind of a hot topic. And when you think of it, you may think of, going off in a retreat for a week and not speaking and just sitting and chanting om, om. Or you might think of having a Buddhist background, which it is. Many pieces of meditation and mindfulness are grounded in Eastern psychology and in Eastern spirituality. And you might even think it's just remembering, I put my keys on the shelf by the candle, and knowing when you go to leave where your keys are. Well, those are all aspects of mindfulness, and you would be right if you think, but they're all aspects of it. They're not each one isn't mindfulness, they're just a part of it. And there's been some really, really cool work done that shows us that mindfulness does some good things. And one of the first things that I want to talk about is actually what it does in our brains, how it is that this focused attention is going to help us do these things like be creative, know what's important in our lives. And so before we get started, you're going to have to work today. But I'm going to ask you to do me a favor. And what I would like you to do is just to let your eyes move gently around. No violence here. We're just going to move them gently around. And then lightly, softly, focus on something that feels just kind of slightly pleasant or really pleasant to you. But find something to focus on that feels pleasant. And just as you look at it, I'd ask you to take a breath in and a breath out. And a breath in, and a breath out. That's it. You don't have to figure out right now why that object is pleasant, although you could. And you don't have to worry about what thoughts came into your mind while you were lightly focusing on that, and watching those thoughts float away, although you could. But one of the simplest mindfulness exercises that you can do is let your eyes focus on a pleasant subject and take two breaths. And over time, this simple exercise will help you develop focus, and it will help you become creative. And here's how it works. Neurological researchers tell us that how we focus our attention actually changes the shape and structure of our brain. When we develop a certain form of attention, Dr. Jon Kabat-Zinn, who's one of the pioneers in mindfulness, he's an oncologist, did a great amount of research in the medical field before he started his mindfulness work. And he says that he calls this being conscious and aware of the present moment a paying attention on purpose and just allowing it to unfold without any judgment. And when we do that, it changes the way the neurons fire in our brains. And when we begin to, with an intention, to even that intention just to quiet our mind, that place where we pay attention in our brain fires up. And at the same time, the frontal cortex regions decrease, which signals a filtering out process of all that is not important. So the area that pays attention increases, and the area that notices peripheral stuff like worrisome thoughts and what ifs and all of that actually decreases. And at the same time as we pull that focus inward and we become less aware of our external environment, especially if we'd like maybe softly shut our eyes and bring our attention to our breath, we actually soften the part of our brain that creates the self, not self, boundary. Now, it's called the right parietal lobe for any of those that keep a map of your brain in your pocket. But over time, we'll also see changes in our hippocampus and our amygdala. This is important because these are areas that give emotional significance to events that have happened either in the past or events that we anticipate happening in the future. And so it'll soften those. And so this is the reason that you've maybe read about mindfulness work being done with trauma victims, being done with others who have faced serious events. And this is why it works. To put it very simply, mindfulness softens that area of our brain that clings to the emotional detritus of past events. And as we begin to pull even deeper inward, we expand our mindfulness practice, we also then, a peaceful state starts to arise from our parasympathetic nervous system, and other hormones trigger a sympathetic nervous response that produces this really clear and alert state. So even though someone watching us would probably not think we're doing, there's Marcy, she's sitting there again, would not even notice that we're doing anything. There's a lot going on internally, and there's a lot going on that's happening in our brain, but there's other things going on in our body as well. Our heart rate lowers, our blood pressure lowers, and our breathing rate goes down, all because of what's happening in our amygdala. So as that softens and relaxes, our breathing softens and relaxes, and our heart rate and those things. So that sounds pretty good, doesn't it? The nice thing is that it doesn't take weeks and weeks of a silent retreat to get these results. Dr. Kabat-Zinn's work, among others, and I did some work in this as well, shows that the benefits kick in a very short time. Just about the same amount of time it takes for this process not to feel awkward. I did a mindfulness project with adolescents, and all of them reported that this is kind of weird at first. You know, we're doing that thing with our breathing, but that awkwardness, that weirdness starts to go away after a very short time. And just about the time that awkwardness goes away is when the benefits start to kick in and the benefits begin. And it doesn't take very long. Usually just a daily practice of a week or 2 weeks will be when that will start. And so that's the science behind it. And now I'm going to ask you to do something else. So we've been sitting here for a little while. So I'd like you to wiggle around a little bit in your chair. We're going to do some rumpusing here. Move your shoulders and your arms, you know, move your hips. Let's stretch if you need to. Just take a little bit and kind of move and change your position. Okay, yeah, very good. Now, I'm going to ask you just to stop and allow yourself to settle back in your seat. Feel your spine make contact with the back of your chair. Take a deep breath and feel how that changes the contact with your chair. Maybe you feel your shoulder blades a little more, maybe feel your spine just a little bit. But notice that contact with your chair. Now notice your toes or your feet. Notice where they make contact with the ground. See if you can get more contact there. Feel your toes touch, maybe all of your heel. Good. Now I'm going to ask you to breathe in again. And as you do, sink deeper into your chair. See if you can just sit heavier. Feel your backside and your sit bones and allow yourself to just be solidly in your chair. Congratulations. You've just done one of the most basic yet one of the most sound exercises for focusing. If I were to give you a math problem right now, Dr. Dan Goleman would tell us that you would do better on that math problem than you did before we did that exercise. You would execute a difficult piano scale with maybe a little bit more grace. Or if you were in the middle of a heated discussion, you would be able to address the points of the discussion and what the discussion was actually about in a better place. Those of you who are baseball fans, Evan Longoria, one of our really good players and hitters right now, talks about how mindfulness, he's very public. He has a mindfulness coach. And he talks about how mindfulness has helped him really focus on what's important in the game. He believes he's able to pick up subtle cues about what the pitch is going to be. I'm getting too close. I'm popping. About what the pitch is going to be and where it's going to be before the ball's even thrown, just by watching subtle cues of the pitcher. Because remember what we talked about when we were talking about the brain's work. When we do mindfulness, when we pay that focused attention without judgment, our brain will pick up, this is what's important, this is what's not. So we start to make those connections. And it is just that undivided attention that helps us find the meaning necessary to be creative. Black Elk puts it this way. We regard all created beings as sacred and important, for everything has a washangi or influence which can be given to us, through which we may gain a little more understanding if we are only attentive. If we are attentive. If we are present. It is that hot moment, that attentive moment, however brief, that is renewing. It is an opening. And it leads to this influence of the one direction. It leads to creativity. Theologian Matthew Fox says it nicely. Creativity is not a noun or even a verb. It is a place. It is a space. It is a gathering, a union, a where. And that where is where mindfulness helps us to find. We can get to that space. Meister Eckhart calls it the divine intimacy, that connection between us and God. It is within this divine attentive space that creativity occurs. The very root word of the word art means an increase in life. And through paying attention with openness and non-judgment, we can direct our creative impulses. We can choose attributes that we want to embody, and we can mindfully ask ourselves in the moment if we're on the right track. Is what I'm doing helping create peace or fostering compassion or not? Am I doing what I'm doing this moment with a sense of service or a sense of obligation? That's an important question. Poet Mark Nepo writes of this and says that mindful attention helps us make a very important distinction. He says that in our jobs, our families, even in our hobbies, we become driven. We move faster and faster to the next big thing, the next milestone, the next car, the next quilt, the next promotion. And he says that a gift of mindfulness, the big gift of mindfulness, is that it allows us to move from what we are being driven to do to what we're being drawn to do. What are we drawn to? What pulls our energy forward? What are we called into? What space are we being drawn to? In St. John, we really read of the living waters that flow and flow, from which we drink and we're not tired. and that divine intimacy, that divine connection. So I'm going to ask you again to take a breath and allow your eyes to rest softly, but this time on something that you find particularly beautiful. Just find something you find particularly beautiful. Notice it. And tell yourself what it is that makes it beautiful. What particular qualities about that your eyes are resting on make it so beautiful for you? And this brings us to what I would wish to conclude to today. Mindful attention can help us with what we're looking for in life. All of us probably chose something different. Maybe you chose looking out. There's so many beautiful things out the window. Or looking at a friend or a lover's hands or something that helped create beauty. But being mindful of that brings this scattered energy and this scattered attention, and it can help us focus on what we would like to find in our lives. One of my favorite mindfulness studies was done at the Rhode Island School of Design, which is an upper-tier academy for graphic arts. And students in an interior living class were given a bracelet. And the bracelet's very similar. This one that I wear actually counts my steps, which probably need to be more every day than they are. It's an activity bracelet. But they were given a bracelet very similar to this. And that bracelet would buzz randomly 10 to 12 times during the day. They didn't know when it was going to buzz. And when it buzzed, they had to notice wherever they were, they had to find something beautiful, and they had to write down what it was about, what was beautiful. Maybe they noticed the juxtaposition of the green trees against the blue sky, or maybe they noticed the pattern of a classmate's shirt, or maybe they noticed the sound of someone's voice. But they had to, every time it buzzed, they had to come up they had to notice something beautiful. And so they did this for 2 weeks, and then they were given the assignment of creating a diorama of a room, and which was a very common assignment for their class. They had done that several times before, and then they were asked afterwards. It was a self-report study. They were asked afterwards about that experience. What was that experience like for you? Now, they're creative people, so they're used to creating, but they commented on how they felt like they had more energy for the project. They felt like their experiences, what they had created, were more innovative. They felt like that things didn't quite look the way that they had looked before. And they also reported more joy in doing the project. Now, this was all self-report, and I'm sure that were lots of ways that we could tear the study apart. But the important thing was that they were able to for 2 weeks, they had been noticing random beautiful things. And then they were able to take that then, and they believed that they were able to apply that to their work. On a personal note, we're going to be open and vulnerable here, right? I'm not a patient person by nature, genetics, or upbringing. And so a patience is always whenever it's like, oh, what virtue would you like to work on? Oh, let's go after patience. And so I don't like waiting in lines and all that kind of stuff. And about a month, 6 weeks ago, I had an experience that I snapped at a service provider a little bit and who I needed to have more patience with, and I felt terrible. And I went back and I apologized, and I said, I know you're doing your work. I know you're busy. I had another appointment I needed to get to and all this. And I apologized, and she accepted my apology and was really surprised I'd come back. But I thought, I need to practice what I preach here a little bit. And so I gave myself the task of for a week, I was going to write down 10 things where I saw patience. 10 experiences, 10 items, whatever, where I found patience. And at first, I'll tell you, it was really hard. I would get, I got the first, I think I had three, and I'm like, okay, there's got to be more. But by the end of the week, I started to notice things. And I noticed the college kid in the crosswalk walking behind the older couple who was taking their time getting across the crosswalk. He didn't barge around them. He didn't barge through them. Just very respectfully waited for them to cross, and then he crossed. I noticed my tomatoes that were just at the perfect amount of ripeness, red and juicy, and they hadn't hurried along. They hadn't tried to, I got to get ripe before this rain comes. They had taken their time. I was in a coffee shop, and I noticed a young girl, three or four. She was just playing with her silverware and talking to them, and her parents were having a fairly significant, it looked to me like anyway, significant conversation, and she was just being very patient. And so I started noticing these things, and I felt over that time I felt patience grow in me, and I've also felt. I see it now, and I even comment to other people, look how patient they're being. They all kind of look at me, but I did find that it was beneficial, that it was helpful. And so I think that there's all sorts of ways that we can use mindfulness in our lives. I think that we can use it to figure out what's important for us. We can use it to help make decisions. We can think of what is it that I would like more of in my life, and then we can use that present focused moment to find it. There are lots of patient people out there. There's lots of friendship out there. There's lots of loyalty out there. There's lots of joy out there. And we can use that focused attention to find those moments as well as the ones that we have in our own life. So I'm going to end today with a little bit of a longer mindfulness exercise. And so I'm just going to invite you again, very gently, to shut your eyes. Find a place in your chair that feels comfortable for you. Your hands may either rest at your side or gently on your lap. If you're here with a loved one, you may want to hold their hand, but you don't have to. And just draw your breath in. And begin to pull your attention inside. You may still notice things in the room, the sound of the air conditioning, other things. But just very gently, just for now, pull your attention inside. Feel that breath as it enters. Either your nose or your mouth. Feel as it moves down through your lungs into your abdomen. And we release. As we breathe in again, as you breathe in, notice the space that breath takes. Notice the space that it takes in your lungs, your abdomen. Feel that breath there. Hold for a beat and then release. And as you release, you may feel your chest sink just a bit. But one more breath in. As you breathe in again, I'd like you to lift your chin just slightly and imagine, see a bright light somewhere above you. When you breathe in, feel that warmth of that light hit your face, the top of your head, and release. Breathe in again and allow that warm light to travel down over the crown of your head, over your shoulders, down through the trunk of your body, and release. Breathing in, that light travels over your head, your shoulders, down through your arms, into your fingers, your hips, your knees, your toes. You may feel your hands and your feet even just tingle with the energy of that breath. We release. One more breath in. And feel that energy of your breath as it travels all the way down your body, out your feet, and into the ground.
Very, very gently, I'm going to ask you to wiggle your toes just a little bit. Wiggle your fingers. Maybe shift your hips from side to side or your shoulders from side to side. We can roll our head back and maybe move it forward just a little bit. And then whenever you're ready, you may gently open your eyes. Thank you very much for your time today. I want to leave you with some words from my very favorite poet, Mary Oliver. Was she the genius? Was that I recognized that. This is her poem called Prayer. It doesn't have to be the blue iris. It could be the weeds in a vacant lot or a few small stones. Just pay attention. Then patch a few words together and don't try to make them elaborate. This isn't a contest, but a doorway into thanks and a silence in which another voice may speak. That's a prayer by Mary Oliver. Thank you again.
Thank you for your talk. I was going to say I read something that was a current event until I realized that this week was probably in a doctor's office. It was noted that the doctor that cited or termed the ADD syndrome died. And I just was curious what age group you work with mostly and whether that type of an issue was in kind of part of what you dealt with.
With ADD, is that what you said?
Right.
Yes. The study I did was with adolescents. It was actually with ninth graders in a biology class. And we were looking at if actually doing a mindfulness exercise in class would increase their mindfulness. And then what that experience was like for them. And we found that it did. But it's interesting that you mentioned that because there is a great deal of work right now being done on emotional regulation and executive regulation, the function of knowing when it's okay to speak out and when it's not okay, during a class and things like that, and that is a work that is being done by individuals who are interested in ADD and ADHD, and so they're finding that the three things that are very helpful are first of all enough physical exercise. That's a whole nother speech on why we make kids who have trouble sitting in class stay in for recess. But the physical exercise, a regular schedule, and mindfulness practice, being body aware. A lot of mindfulness that would be similar to what we did with where are your toes, where are your hands, where are you doing that. And that's finding there's some really cool things that are coming out that can be as beneficial, if not more, than some heavy doses of medication.
Yeah. Part of this article claimed that he had confessed that his research and claim was completely bogus. That it was
about mindfulness.
Well, about the ADD issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, we know that attention is a skill, and that focus is a skill, and that like any skill, it can improve over time and with practice and with instruction. So, yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much. My name's Kathy Hedge, and we had I was a mentor, went into classrooms I observed a math teacher, and she had gone to a mindfulness workshop. In fact, the district had provided it for all the math teachers. And she would begin each day where the students would stand, and they'd feel their pulse, and they'd stand on one foot, and then she'd talk them through a relaxation. It took, maybe 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And I could watch these seventh graders just go, And then they went in and they did their math, but she did that every day with them. Mm-hmm. And the students, if they'd come in and they stand around the walls ready to do their experience, and it was amazing to watch. But I also need to tell you that I was an English teacher, and
so you diagrammed a few sentences.
Yeah, but I refused to do diagramming sentences. I only did them once because my principal made me. But otherwise, one of my former students saw me about 2 years ago. And he said, boy, you know the one thing I remember most about you? And I was thinking, oh, I smile or whatever. There'd be something. He says, we always knew when we were too loud because all of a sudden you'd start breathing.
I love that. Thank you.
Well, mine's a seventh grade English teaching experience for which I was totally unqualified. But I was broke, and it was the job I could find. And one Monday morning, I woke up and I couldn't talk at all. And I remembered the lesson plans I'd turned in on Friday, and I was so embarrassed that a substitute would see them because they were just crap. So I went to work, and I wrote on the board the alphabet and numbers through 30, and yes, no, later, sit down, be quiet. A few things like that, and I, as they came into class, I pointed, I can't talk. And so these seventh graders were like this all morning, you know, all hour. And I did everything. I did a week's work in the class because they were so eager to get on to the next thing. And I got my voice back over the lunch hour, but I didn't tell anybody. And so, I didn't want the afternoon classes to be 3 days behind the morning classes. So, I've thought often about how I just happened to hit on the right thing. You can't come in every day and pretend to be, to have laryngitis. So you need to find something. Maybe 4 times a year I did. With those seventh graders.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Charlie. I too am a recovering English teacher.
I think we need a support group here.
I'm not going to. Well, what I'm interested in mostly is years ago I had a Japanese girlfriend, long before this lady, and she got me interested in Japanese culture, which I really have almost no knowledge of. It's been a long time anyway. Maybe Diane, who lived in Japan, will know. But I seem to remember a concept the Japanese had. They called it muga or something, M-U-G-A in English or Roman alphabet, where you were doing something so well that you were unconscious of doing it. And that was a state of grace, sort of, if you want to use a Western term, and maybe something like mindfulness. And that always stuck in my demented and hyperactive mind when I was working construction or whatever. And then years later, when I couldn't do that physical work and have that happen to me, that mug or whatever it is, I discovered that, you know, it could be writing, which I do, almost anything. Could be even when you guys are all talking about diagramming sentences. One quick anecdote from my career as a college English teacher down the river. And I would always have six girls, and I'm sorry to be sexist about this, folks, but there would be six girls. This is 1960-something also, sitting in the front row. And we had to spend 2 weeks diagramming sentences, like your principal, Kathy. And I just don't have the feel for that. I don't have any abstract intelligence, and I hated it and so on. But I would do the night before stuff, and I would get up there, and I would put the sentence on the board. And inevitably, one of these six girls would say, well, Mr. Kempthorne, that's a equatorial pretonomial whatever, you know.
And your line should go that way instead of this way.
I was mindfully embarrassed. But anyway, I would appreciate any comment you might have on that. Japanese comment.
Well, interestingly enough, a lot of the work on that, you may have heard the term flow, being in the flow.
And a lot of the original work, some of the basic work on that, has been done either through the martial arts, and then it's also been applied to modern athletics. And this is exactly what we're talking about, is that space where the other peripheral things that we don't that aren't important to what we're doing fall away, and we're able to focus intently on what's ahead of us, or what we're doing. And one of the things that happens is kind of a side note that we often focus on to say, yeah, that's how I know, is because time ceases to have a meaning for us. Remember that part of our brain that defines self, non-self. Time is one of those components. So as we fall into that place Matthew Fox talks about, we do lose track of time. We do lose track of who we're with or where we're at, and we just focus on what the moment is. And a great deal of the early work in that was done around the field of athletics.
I'm going to be an oddball here saying how great it is to diagram sentences.
And we need more of it.
I never did this in high school when I was in public school, but from grades 3 to 5 in Catholic school, we diagrammed them, I think, almost every day. And as a visual learner, it was like making the sentence into a tree. Mm-hmm. And I loved it so much. And I can say, you know, every job I've ever had has been because of writing strength, and I credit it to those nuns and their diagrams. But what it made me think of when you talked about diagramming sentences was, you know, for some people who are visual learners, how that kind of meditation on something visual, like you took mm-hmm. us through, how powerful that can be. This past week, I had a chance to do a visual thinking strategies exercise with the director of the Beach Museum, Linda Duke, who's a mm-hmm. wonderful lady and very well skilled in this. It's an exercise where you are suspending judgment in a group of people, and you're just hearing what everyone sees in that object or that painting or whatever it is. And I found it to be incredible. In fact, it was really hard to be that patient for this exercise, but I left with this renewed sense of focus and energy, and definitely it was a mindful practice. So mm-hmm. it made me think of that when we were talking about the diagramming sentences. I think for me it was a mindful practice as a kid.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So for me, it's the elephant in the room. Almost everything I hear or see relates back to yoga. And I just want to say that mindfulness is a wonderful English word expressing the ancient Sanskrit and the ancient tradition called yoga. Mm-hmm. And also, I just want to add to that the second Yoga Sutra in the accepted yoga wisdom of Patanjali is the fact that yoga is the quieting of the mental jumping. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's all.
Thanks, Anna.
I'm Grace MacMillan, and I'm a busy mom. I have like a almost seven-year-old and 3-year-old. So mindfulness for me pretty much only happens when I'm like washing dishes by hand. But that's a really good time to be mindful. But I haven't done any meditation in years and years and years. And I want to thank you for like walking us through those meditations, because it reminded me of when I was little and I would have nightmares. My dad would walk me through the light coming in and almost like pushing out the bad dream. And I recognized like my dad would meditate all the time, and this was like his way to give me that. Mm-hmm. And thanks for letting me remember that.
Thank you for sharing that.
I have this really... my name's Sylvia Beeman. I have this really annoying rash that I got from wearing a splint on my arm because I have tendonitis, and it's really bothering me and itchy and stuff, but when we did our mindfulness, it went away. So it's not bothering me anymore. But when I was in college a long time ago, there was a required class called conscious relaxation, and my sister, who was 2 years ahead of me, she took it when she was a freshman, and it involved, we had to bring some pillows, we had to lie on the floor in the dark, and it involved visualizing our body and thinking about it getting big and flat, and it involved breathing. And my sister was so excited about it, she told me. And so I've always done it since then, and it's been very helpful to me. And I also listen to this when I have a day to do my artwork. This man who is a career pathologist, he's from Pakistan, and he talks about limbic breathing. So, and also I've been taught a lot by Anna. All these things are based on breathing. Mm-hmm. And these, when I'm really troubled, these things always help me, concentrating on my breathing to still my wandering, frantic mind. Thank you for your talk. It was really interesting.
Thank you.
When we were kids, my brothers and I, maybe we were 7, 8, 9 in that range, we discovered the concept of recognizing and appreciating what you might call mindfulness in others. So we would, for example, we'd observe somebody being very engaged in an activity, not being aware of anything around them, being totally concentrated on the activity. And when we observed that, we got a tingling feeling of appreciation, which we called the boom booms.
And I love that.
Every time my brothers and I get together, we wonder whether anybody else knows what the boom booms are.
Oh, I love that. Thank you.
Since we're still in general conversation, I have two things. One is that researchers studied how dogs focus. You know, this has to do with shutting out everything else and somehow being open so you're able to see massive amounts of information. So you could easily predict, maybe, if you knew the cues, what pitch was going to come at you. There are tells. And so they said that dogs actually, you know, they have something, they can track their pupils, and the dogs look at the left side of your face to read you. They don't even look at the right side so much, but, you know, if they want to see what you're really thinking and what you're about to do, they focus on one side of your face to read it. And the other thing is that, okay, let's just have half of the room, people who like to diagram, come over here, and you other people go over there. And I'm an unreformed English teacher. And the one cool thing, exercise that I devised for my students, because they were acting, you know, all moany and groany about it, like that it's no fun. I said, okay, what we're going to do today is I'm going to write Jabberwocky, you know, the nonsense poem. "'Twas brillig, and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the borogoves, and the mome raths outgrabe." So I wrote it on there, and I said, now you're going to tell me what part of speech each of those words is. And they loved it because it was a game. And so I think it's your approach to things, not what you're doing. So there.
And the debate continues.
I just have to say this as a foreign language teacher. It really helps if students know what a verb is. Mm-hmm. And my students complain that they don't learn that in English anymore. Mm-hmm. A lot of students complain that they have to learn it the hard way mm-hmm. when they come in the foreign language classroom.
You're right. Stand and sing with us as you are able. 127.
Can I see another's woe? Been blessed with the gift of awareness. Let us use that great gift to become aware and to celebrate the awareness of all creatures with whom we share this beautiful planet. Thank you.